3, 2, 1. Welcome back to Podcast Noor. I am your host, Noor Tajouri, and I'd like to personally welcome you to this storytelling session, no matter what your intention of listening is. This is our second episode with an anonymous guest, the brilliant author of the memoir, Hijab Butch Blues. Lamia H. is queer, non-binary, and Muslim. Yes, there are people who are all three. They are a writer and organizer based in New York City. Lamia's work has appeared in Salon, Vice, Vox, and others. Their organizing work centers around creating spaces for LGBTQ plus Muslims, fighting Islamophobia, and abolishing prisons. We recorded this conversation during the month of Ramadan and reflected on the similarities between Muslim community care and queer community care. We talked about the common American Muslim struggle of double lives. We got into the concept of questioning faith and even shared around our personal relationships with hijab. I read Hijab Butch Blues in less than 2 days. The writing is profound, personal, and clear. Lamia poses questions throughout the book for people of all faiths. And it is no surprise that the book was featured as Roxane Gay's March 2023 selection of the Audacious Book Club. I also feel a deep sense of urgency with this episode. Homophobia and transphobia are rampant in the United States, and it has been weighing heavily on my heart the role that many American Muslims have unfortunately been playing in this. Scholars and imams that I grew up listening to are now making dangerous anti-LGBTQ plus statements. And I believe it is more important now than ever to amplify the human stories of community members who need our protection and love. I want to thank all of the queer people in my life who have time and time again shown up in solidarity when Muslims have been marginalized and persecuted. May we always be a protection and light for each other. May we always lead with love. And may you enjoy this episode of Podcast Noor with Lamia H. Amazing. Okay. So thank you so much for your time and for this incredible book that I read in 2 sittings in 24 hours, less than 4 hours, actually. I know, I'm such a fan. You know, what's so interesting about this is that the first person who told me about your book is actually one of my best friends, named Becca, who lives in Italy, and she saw it there, found it there or something. And she sent me the book and she was like, I think you would really love this. And then I think somebody else also told me about it, but anyway, I saw Glennon Doyle's review of the book and I was like, oh my gosh, I got so excited. And I was like, I have to read this and I have to talk to this person. So I'm so honored and grateful that you're on the pod and that you said yes. So thank you. Welcome, Lamia.
Thanks. I really appreciate that because I feel so honored to be on here because I've been following your work for a while and just, I don't know, it's also just so great to be talking to someone who's Muslim about this. Yeah. So I'm really excited for our conversation.
Me too. I was talking to Adam earlier and he was like, so how are you approaching this interview, like journalistically, how'd you prepare for it? I was like, this is an interview I feel like I've been prepared for a very long time. Like, I just, there's so many questions and so many points of conversation that I feel like I look forward to us having right now because, I think that, you know, for me as somebody who's on a spiritual journey myself and asking the big questions of who am I and what do I believe and all of the things in between, I think that when it comes to like bodily autonomy and just like transparently, like queerness in the Muslim community and like and hijab specifically, those are two things that I'm always just like, I have like this big question mark around of like, why are we so obsessed with this in like a way that isn't leading with like love and autonomy and agency? So Anyway, the way we kick off these conversations is a very simple question, which is, how is your heart doing today, Lamia?
You know, that's like, I think that's one of the hardest questions for me to answer, because I don't know what your upbringing was like, but in my very immigrant Muslim upbringing, we did not talk about feelings like at all. Like, I even came to the realization that you're supposed to feel your feelings really late in life. Like, it just, you know, wasn't intuitive to me. I didn't realize that, you know, you're just supposed to feel them as opposed to suppressing them or just glossing them over. So answering that question is really hard for me, because I've had to like learn how to answer it both like honestly aloud and then also just for myself. I'm going to be totally vulnerable here and be like, I'm kind of nervous. I get nervous every time I'm doing an interview or podcast. I get nervous in general when I'm doing anything that requires sort of like speaking, which is why I guess I'm a writer. I'm both nervous and also just really excited.
Where do you feel your nervousness?
Oh my God. I've had so much therapy to be able to answer that question, but like always in my throat. Mm. What about you? Where do you feel things?
It's funny that you said throat, because I think sometimes it's often my throat as well. I also have like a thyroid related autoimmune disease. And I was talking to my aunt who also has one about it. And she was saying how like, you know, trauma in this area oftentimes is like rooted in when you feel like you weren't able to say something that you needed to say or speak on something, or if you've had trouble like getting something out that needed to be said. And so sometimes I'll feel like a lot of warmth around my throat as well, actually. And I feel like being able to notice that is a really big win, because I think, you know, you can feel nervousness all over your entire body, but when you're able to pinpoint like the source, you can better ask that question as like, what is the message that my body is telling me right now or is sending to me right now? So.
Right. Yeah. And then that makes it easier to address it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oof. Well, so I read this book, shared it immediately. And even in simply just sharing your book, I just was really bombarded with a lot of messages.
Yeah.
And I had people who, you know, I don't always talk to or hadn't reached. We just had so many people reach out to us about the book. And it was so interesting how activating and how triggering it was, because to me, I really thought it was such a beautiful and phenomenal approach to writing. Like, you use these amazing stories from the Quran and the prophets that we heard growing up to really deeply reflect and document your own personal journey of coming into your own. Like, it was really about coming into yourself as an individual. And it makes me sad when I find that people react to somebody documenting and speaking their truth. And so I thought about you a lot during those few days, because I was just like, man, this is just from sharing it. I know that you have cultivated a really beautiful community, but I have to ask, tell me about the feelings that you had leading up to publishing Hijab Butch Blues and the reaction or the response that you got shortly after.
I definitely felt a lot of feelings in the lead up. I was definitely very sort of like scared and nervous, because I mean, like, part of it is just the act of writing a memoir in general. Cause you do all the writing sort of by yourself and, you know, solitarily, and then you put it out there in the world and then suddenly all these people are reading. And a lot of what I wrote feels really vulnerable because it feels really sort of like honest, and it just felt like I was, you know, talking about myself in ways that I don't generally with other people. And so I think I was just like really nervous in general about that aspect of it, that, you know, suddenly everyone will like know all of these things about me. And then I was definitely like very, I was scared about the sort of like Muslimness of it and how it'll be received. And to be quite honest, I was actually like scared on both ends. I was scared about how my critiques about queerness will be received too, and the way that those can sometimes get the way that queerness can end up reproducing normativity in these ways that are really hard, and also sort of like racism and classism and transphobia. So I was scared about that. I was like, will people still invite me to their potlucks? Then I was also just like really sort of scared about how it'll be received in terms of Muslim communities. And part of it was also like, will Muslim people read it? Will people be so sort of like defensive because of the synopsis, or will they just sort of like glance at the title and then have their preconceived notions and then not read it? Even though for me, what was important to me when I was writing this book was that I wanted it to be really, really Muslim. Like I wanted to not, you know, apologize for faith or for the way in which our stories should also be considered canon. And the way that like, you know, we like, I didn't want to explain things. I didn't want to apologize for faith and for piety and for taking Islam seriously. And so, yeah. And so I was, because of that, especially, I think I was really nervous for how it would be received.
It's, you know, I've also had experiences where things get taken out of context, or people have reactions based on a headline, or people have a reaction based on a lack of the fuller story. And for that response, like that very surface level response, I very much feel like that's just not in our control. Those are people who are having opinion, who make those opinions and who publicize those opinions. You can have opinions, but like to have the audacity to broadcast them or share them and take up that space without your opinion being fully formed or thought or engaged, I feel like that you just kind of have to like weed out, because it's simply truly a reflection of somebody's own inner insecurity and wanting to control a specific image. And I think that, you know, when it comes to Muslim representation specifically, because there is still such a lack of Muslim representation in media in general, that when there's like a hyper individualized experience that's documented that people want to resist, there's this reaction that I had, you know, when people were reaching out, and it was just like, who are you to, you know, say, oh no, this story is not valid or is not welcome. Like it's a person is a story, and their story is their truth, and they get to take up all the space that they want. And if you feel so strongly about it being different than yours, then go work on yours and go focus on yours. And so, I really loved and admired and respected that you maintained, you know, not just like the Muslimness of it all, but the fact that I was revisiting the stories of the prophets throughout your book in a way that I had never done myself. I had never asked those specific questions around it. And something that the book really taught me and your writing really taught me is what a beautiful act of faith it is to ask questions that you didn't know that you were allowed to ask. And I think I often thought of that in like very personal regards, like questions I was asking about myself. But in when you were sharing, you know, the stories of Maryam or the prophet Abraham or even Yunus and Yusuf, like all of those stories came with questions and a rethinking that was so personal. So I would love to just understand a little bit of how you and yourself got to a place where you were able to rethink the stories that you were taught and ask bigger questions. And I know it started with the story of Maryam for you when you were younger. So I'd love to know how that kind of changed the way that your brain thought about stories?
Yeah. So I think it's so interesting because even in the Quran itself, I think there are so many stories of people, including prophets, like constantly questioning God and like constantly questioning their faith. Yeah. And to me, that's so powerful. Like, you know, Ibrahim, for example, has like talked to God and like still like is like, hey, I'm not totally sure that I know or that I understand how you would, you know, bring back something that's dead. How would you like make it alive again? And like the fact that, you know, Ibrahim is asking God this directly, like it just like, I find that so powerful. And, you know, that's not the only story. There's also Musa who was like, hey, God, I'd love to see you. And then, you know, Allah's like, what? No, you know, this like mountain can't bear to see me. So how do you think you would be able to survive, you know, being like seeing me? And then, yeah, there are just like so many other stories. There's also the story of the man who like comes across, a dead donkey and just, yeah. And I just like, I find it so powerful, that we in our holy text, we're being taught to question faith. And you know, at the end of the day, I think that's like one of the most powerful things about faith in general is that it exists because of doubt. And it exists because of questions. Because otherwise if you knew for sure, then like it wouldn't be faith.
Yeah.
But there's just something about it. And the fact that it's like folded into our religion feels just so powerful. And And to me, you know, I read a lot as a kid. I was like always reading books and I was always sort of like questioning the characters and their motivations and their decisions and being like, why is this person doing this? Why not this? And to me growing up, it actually felt pretty consistent to do that with stories from the Quran as well. And, you know, not everyone is open to questioning. Not everyone is open to listening to these questions. And, you know, I definitely had teachers, Quran teachers, or like, you know, I'd go to talks and, you know, people would just be really uncomfortable at questions. But
share some of that? Like, I'm really curious about that because that's something that I'm like, you know, investigating right now is like, why are we so afraid to ask questions? And because you are, you know, I also strongly believe that like this, our faith tradition is one that encourages asking questions, but even when it's right there in the faith itself, very explicitly, when the actual act of asking questions happens, it's not always met with a very open response or response that encourages exploration anywhere outside of the way we were traditionally taught. So what did that look like to you? And like, what is a question that you may be asked a teacher and how did they respond? And how did you start to understand, oh, this is like a human problem. This is like a person problem. This is like an insecurity.
Yeah. What I
doubt.
Yeah, what I find most fascinating is that there's no correlation between who is open to sort of like being asked questions and like, in quote, progressiveness. So, for example, when I was younger, I had this Quran teacher who, you know, was an imam at a mosque nearby. And, you know, he was just like very traditional and, you know, had a beard, wore a thobe and like, you know, just like was like super traditional. But like, I remember being like 6 or 7 and learning to read the Quran with him. And he would just like be so open to answering me and my brothers, like totally ridiculous questions. And there's this part in the book actually, where I talk about this incident in which I asked him if God was a man or a woman. And he was just like so patient being like, well, neither, even though, you know, he could have, you know, deflected the question or like he could have, you know, been like, well, you know, in the Quran, God uses like Hua as a pronoun and, you know, but like, he was just like, he just took our questioning so seriously. And I think there's this way in which people condescend towards kids, especially, especially when kids have like questions about faith and they just assume that kids won't be able to handle complexity, even though kids are just like constantly navigating their worlds and like constantly learning things. And so actually they like, they're like thinking is so complex already. But yeah, that's definitely like something that, you know, comes to mind, this incident in which my very traditional Quran teacher took us so seriously. And, you know, meanwhile, you know, there have been other times when, another story that I write about in the book is when I was at this halakha, at this like feminist halakha, where, you know, I was using they pronouns for God and like people kind of freaked out. And so it's really interesting to me how, yeah, there's just like no correlation between sort of like progressiveness and tradition, and I guess like traditionality and the being able to like handle questions.
Hi there, Noor here from At Your Service. At Your Service is a storytelling company. We tell stories as a form of service. And the way I think about it is story first, medium second. Meaning, we don't think, hey, I really want to produce a podcast. What should it be about? No, we think of it as we have a story we want to tell. What is the best medium, the best way to tell it? Maybe it is a podcast. Maybe it's a documentary series, a virtual talk, a speaker series, a dinner party. Maybe it's a book club. The list goes on and on. We also love being of service to companies and brands and nonprofits to help them tell the best story possible so that they can serve their audience and their communities. So if you want to check out more of our work, you can do so at ays.media. You can also find the transcripts for all our podcast episodes right there. And if you're enjoying this podcast right now, it would mean so much to me if you could leave a review and give us some feedback. Let us know if you like this style of podcast or if you're looking for something else. And of course, if you have any stories you'd like to pitch for us, you can do that through our website as well. As always, at your service. Well, what's a question that you're asking yourself right now these days?
Oh, I'm asking myself a lot of questions, always, but, Ramadan just ended and I've been thinking a lot about community and, I don't know, kind of like the extension of community, and community care to people that we, don't necessarily know. I've been thinking about Sudan a lot and, just like all of these people basically made refugees overnight, having to leave one's home. I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about, what are our rights towards other people and, people that, you know, we may not directly be in community with, as in like people who we don't see on a regular basis, but like who exist and are, and should be part of our networks of care. I'm also thinking a lot about trans kids and, just like healthcare rights being taken away, people who are pregnant and, you know, wanting sort of like reproductive justice. I'm thinking a lot about how to extend community care to people who are really struggling right now.
Well, what does community care look like for yourself? And how have you redefined community as who you are today?
It's definitely something that I think changed the trajectory of my life. And I think it's so interesting because I think there's so many parallels between sort of like queer community care and Muslim community care.
Totally.
Yeah, I think about that a lot. And this idea of sort of like why going to a mosque or like going to someplace on a regular basis, like how that creates community and how that creates networks of care. I think of people going to like Friday prayers every week and like seeing the same people over and over and noticing when someone isn't there or just the way in which that sets up ways to help each other, and be there for each other, whether it's, you know, like babysitting or helping someone out if they're facing food insecurity. But then also, you know, it's really interesting because queer communities have that too. And it was definitely something that I feel like I was missing a lot when I, you know, just moved here and was learning how to be a person in the US and then also like a person after college. And, you know, just really growing into what kind of life I want to live, who are the people that I want to be surrounded by, and finding sort of like queer Muslim community specifically just really like changed my life. It taught me so much about organizing, about conflict, about like how to be in community with people that you wouldn't necessarily choose as your friends, people that, you know, intergenerational friendships, how to show up for each other. And I think seeing other people live their Muslimness and live their queerness really helped me come into those identities for myself.
What does it mean to be queer and Muslim to you today? But I would also love for you to reflect on how you would have answered that question when you were a young person who was just figuring out they were queer.
You know, it's really interesting because I think people expect this sort of like conflict between the two identities. And I don't think I really grew up experiencing that. I mean, part of it was I didn't have necessarily the words to talk about my queerness. So to me, like, those things weren't necessarily in conflict with each other. They both just were. And, you know, I was figuring out both of them in some ways at the same time. I was figuring out how I wanted to be Muslim. You know, I was figuring out what parts of it like really, really spoke to me and what parts I was angry at and what parts I, how I wanted to interpret things, how I wanted to live my Muslimness. And then I think that there was a similar process with queerness too, where, you know, sometimes it felt very like hegemonic, like there was like one particular way to be queer. You know, you like come out to your parents in this big like fanfare, and then, you know, they can either choose to accept you or not. And then, you know, you're like out and like, here's your life. Whereas that isn't how things have played out for me. And so I feel like I was also really trying to figure out what parts of queerness really spoke to me and which parts like allowed me to live a life that felt intentional and felt was rooted in sort of like community and care and love and justice. And so to me, I feel like I was figuring out both of those at the same time. And I think, you know, I think I'm still figuring them out. I think that's the beauty of both those identities, actually, is that even now I feel like I don't have it entirely figured out, but there are things that I know I value and that I want in my life. And yeah, and you know, again, like, it's so interesting because I think that's what God wants of us too, this idea of sort of like intentionality and effort and constantly like figuring out how we want to live. And so I feel good about that, being in a process of figuring it out.
So how do you like explain that or share that with young people who also may have not, and I shouldn't even just say young people, just people in general who are of the Muslim faith tradition and haven't come out to their family or their friends or are dealing with this like isolation, I think, okay, I should just ask it a lot easier. So I think that Muslims, especially American Muslims in general, you know, we held an iftar last week or a couple weeks ago, and I asked, and somebody mentioned living a double life growing up. And I asked them, I was like, you know what, raise your hand around the table if you're a Muslim and if you've ever felt like you were living a double life. And almost every single hand went up. And this isn't obviously limited to like queerness or anything like that. It's just the fact that, you know, so many American Muslims have felt like they had to have different versions of themselves to the different people around them. And it's rare to have a scenario, especially growing up, where like you feel like you can be your fullest self around your family or your community, especially when there is a lot of judgment or there is a lot of shame or there is a lot of, I can get in trouble for this, or there is a lot of imposing your belief onto someone else. And so, you know, you articulated beautifully in the book what it meant for you to like find community and to find like a community family that you are your fullest self around. And as of, you know, reading the book, your immediate family does not know. And I feel like that parallels or represents a lot of like this, you know, this obstacle of being multiple people to the people that we love so that we can maintain a sense of safety or maintain a sense of like still being loved and still being welcome. And so like, how do you advise people who are navigating that internal battle, who are just like, because I feel like the, you know, compartmentalization of identities can be so exhausting. And so it can be so burdensome, but like, if that ends up being the decision that you make, because that's what gives you the most peace, like, what do you say to people who are like, I don't know, this is getting, I'm really tired.
Oh, that's so real and such a good question. And one that I genuinely don't know how to answer because, yeah, I mean, I guess like the only thing I have to add to your beautifully articulated question is that, I don't know, sometimes leading a double life and sometimes sort of like not telling your parents or your, I guess like wider community certain things just really comes from a place of love and empathy. And I don't know, I think about that a lot in terms of my parents and just and other people who are sort of like navigating their lives and also choosing what to share or not share with their parents. But like, I don't know, sometimes this idea of authenticity and like living your full self, I don't know, like maybe it's okay to sometimes, I don't know, hide parts of yourself from other people. Yeah, I don't know, because sometimes it can be really rooted in just like a love and an empathy and just like a knowing that the person that you're hiding things from just won't understand. And it's not that they don't have the information. It's just sometimes people just don't have the capacity to understand. And, you know, like, and sometimes people come from really like hierarchical cultures where like, respect is such a big thing. And just like, you know, like respecting your elders and just like not fighting back or not asking questions. Like, it's just like, sometimes.
But then there's love. Yes. Like, that's the thing though. But then there's love. And I don't know, Namya. I sometimes when I think about it too, I'm just like, you know, I think about how the families that we come onto this planet with, like we chose each other, we are each other's tests. And like, I've been thinking a lot about how love to me, I believe, is like the source and the root of everything that matters and everything that's real. And that's like the one thing that I know for sure is that the answer is always love. And I think that, you know, I would love if you're comfortable to talk about just like some of the things that you've, and you can feel free to be like, nah, not for me. But like, you know, you are in a loving relationship and you lead this like really beautiful love filled life. And do you ever think about like, I wanting to share that with the people that, you know, love you and have, and know you? And like, is there, when you're with them, or is there ever like a moment of just like, I wish we could go there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's really, really hard. There's something so sad and tragic about it. And there's something just like really heartbreaking about people that I love not knowing that my life is filled with so much love. But yeah, I don't know.
But like, how do you think about, like, how do you, cause you are, I'm asking this for all the people who are going to listen to this and who are in that same, in those same feelings. Like, how do you choose to really navigate that? And how do you, like, is there a period at the end of like, I will never tell my parents, or I will never share this part with them? Or is it a question mark? Is it today I'm not, but maybe tomorrow I will?
No, it's definitely a question mark. And you know, like it obviously like doesn't work for everyone. So I think a lot about like trans folks, for example, who don't necessarily have the luxury of not being out.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, like, I really wish I had some sort of like magical reframing that would make it easier, or that would make it, that would make it like more possible, but it's hard, and you live it. Yeah.
It's, I think that you using that pain or test to, and making it into art and making it into words, is such a beautiful service, because I think simply the act of literally putting together a book and being like, hey, you're not alone. And this is how, this is, it's not like you're like, hey, I figured out how we can do this. It's, I figured out how I do this. And I hope that you can, like, it's the power of representation. I hope that you can see some of yourself in me in this. Well, when was the first time you ever felt properly represented in media?
Properly represented? I still don't feel properly represented.
Hey, I'm Noor Tagori, and I've been telling stories my entire life. For my new podcast, Rep, I've spent years examining a more personal story about how the misrepresentation of Muslims in media has impacted American society. I thought I knew the story because I thought I knew my story. But the more I looked for singular, clear answers, the more questions I had. Our story guides include academics, artists, actors, and we bounce around through American history and culture, witness our present and future unfold, and then we find out how these stories affect all of us. Welcome to Rep.
Expression is a space in the heart that is unleashed and let free. It runs wild.
Listen to Rep on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your shows. I've been thinking a lot. I've just been rethinking hijab a lot too, which is also why this book was so touching and moving for me, because it felt like it's something that, you know, you came to from this place of like your own want and your own reflection on Maryam, the mother of Jesus, and her individuality and power. And so I'd love to know, I never like to ask questions about hijab because I don't like to be asked questions. And that seems to be the only thing that everybody likes to ask me about, but it is in the title of your book. And so I feel like it's okay. But I would love to know like what your relationship with hijab is, and if you ever do rethink it, or what are the questions that you ask about it, or what does it mean to you?
First of all, it's really nice to be talking about this. Like, I don't usually like talking about it, but it's actually like, I love that sort of framing. And I love that, like, I love being able to talk about it with someone who's also grappling with it. I mean, it's definitely something I grapple with a lot. And, you know, it looks different for me on different days. Like sometimes, you know, sometimes my hijab is like, you know, a headscarf, and sometimes it's a beanie, and sometimes it's a backwards hat. So it takes like many shapes and forms. I think the thing I actually really dislike when people make it about modesty or even about like covering your hair as if like,
same,
that's like, yeah, the, yeah, as if like those are sort of like the endpoints or the like, or even like something to strive towards. For me, it's like, it's a way of reminding myself of God. And I think the times in which I've grappled with it the most are weirdly the times that I've needed it the most. I don't know. I think tell me more about that. Oh, yeah, you would pick the like one thing that I dropped in there that was I think to me it's a reminder of God every time I put it on. And you know, obviously this is not an every time I put it on, you know, sometimes I just like put it on,
right?
But to me, when it's working best, it's like, okay, I'm going about my day and here's this thing that I'm doing for God. Here's this thing that like makes me feel closer to so many of the like beautiful, complicated figures in the Quran that I really admire. It makes me feel like I'm part of something that's bigger than myself, like part of, you know, the universe in some way. And I know that's so cheesy, but like, it feels like a connection. And I think that to me, yeah, I think to me, that's like, that's the most important thing. And in the times when I have sort of like not wanted to wear it, or the times that it's taken different forms, I think just like coming back to this idea of sort of like letting that feeling move through me, and like not fighting it, and just sort of like being like, okay, this is like something that I'm grappling with. It's something that I'm asking questions about. It's something that I'm trying to figure out, just like, you know, the prophets were figuring it out.
Do you think you can fully figure it out while wearing it?
Oh my God. Another excellent question.
Well, and I
don't know. I think
as a journalist who is like always striving to be objective and then also internally trying to like be, because like for me, I feel this, since I finished my investigation rep, which like kind of broke me wide open and asking these bigger questions of who are we and why are we the way that we are and why are we alive? I feel like, especially with hijab, that there's such a weight of what you are representing, and because it's being so politicized even recently and stuff, obviously there is a component of like being a public figure who's known while wearing this and all of this stuff, and I'm just like, okay, wait, why am I actually doing this, and have I ever rethought it? And like, is this something that I'm asking all these questions? Right. And then I'm just like, wait, are these questions that I can actually ask while engaging and wearing it? Do I need to become more objective in order to really ask this? And this is like a really tremendous, question to have to ask, because the reality of it is that everyone has an opinion about it. And it's so scrutinized that like, I'm realizing, since the second I started wearing it, it's always been scrutinized. It's always been talked about. So I'm trying to navigate myself, like, what is the most objective and authentic and true way that I can actually ask these questions and find answers that are not influenced by other people?
I can't wait for this like essay or podcast that you're going to do about this, because I think it's going to be so deep, and I think it's going to like, it's going to ask more questions than it answers, which I know is so annoying. But I really can't wait to, I can't wait to see what comes out of your questions.
Out of my downward spiral.
Out of your upward spiral. It really sounds like upward an upward spiral.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's what I'm thinking about. So I would love to know, because as I hear you talk about like your reasons for wearing hijab, I've said all of those reasons out loud too. Like I've said every single thing, and I felt it. And I also am just like, now I'm like, okay, but I think, I don't know, fundamentally I'm like, do I believe that God wants my hair to be covered, or is it about hair, or why is it that when people react so much to seeing hair, like it feels like, you know, a person who chooses to wear it is being reduced to that. And that's not just from Muslims and non-Muslims. It's especially for Muslims. Like it's something that I feel like I'm just like, wait, this reducing me to just this thing that I choose to do is so dehumanizing. And so how do I like kind of take back my own humanity and figure that out for myself? And these are, again, all questions, no answers. And I'm in a very big state of asking questions, but I'd love to know if you've gotten there with your questions.
Yeah. So what's interesting for me is that another angle of questions that, about hijab that like really, has me in a tizzy is the way that it like, it ends up feminizing people. And it really like fucks with notions of gender. But yeah, so I think about it a lot in terms of my gender identity too. I don't know. I think it's interesting because for a really long time, I thought that I couldn't call myself non-binary because I wore hijab, and like, you know, and that is so, it makes me be read as a woman, in this very sort of like overt way. And so to me, what's also been really interesting is sort of like playing with what hijab looks like. Like, so for example, when I wear a beanie and walk down the street, people can't necessarily tell that it's my hijab. And so I don't know, the way that I'm read is so different. And I know it's so cliche to say
this. A lot more non-binary.
Like, yeah, definitely. Yeah. But, you know, sometimes I get the sort of like queer head nod from people, like the like, hey, like I see you, which is really interesting because I do that head nod with hijabis, you know, like every time I see hijabi, I'm like, hey, eye contact, like super secret head nod. Yeah. So to me, another aspect of it is also the sort of like genderedness of it. But I also, on my end, I think weirdly, my wearing hijab also like expands that. Like, yeah. So I don't know. Those are also angles that I'm thinking about a lot.
Yeah. I mean, so, okay. I guess I'll just like ask you, like, what do you think, based on your own reading and interpretation and how you have like come to the faith, what is hijab to you? Like, what is it? Is it about covering our hair and bodies? Like, is it a connection to God? Like, what is it?
Yeah, no, I think it's about like God consciousness. And it can take on different forms. It can take on vastly different forms for people. I also like, I don't know. I just like, I also think that there are multiple paths to God. Like just because the path that I'm on works for me doesn't necessarily mean that it works for other people. And I actually like, I don't think God would be petty enough to be like, hey, here's this other path that is bringing this person closer to them. But like, they'd be like, no, wait, there's only one path. Yeah, I don't know.
That's exactly how I feel. And that's why I say it's like a human problem, because it's like, why do we, even with like the, like wanting to call God they, because God also refers to themselves as we in the Quran and stuff. And just being like, why do we think that like the majesty of God, who we can't fully comprehend in our brains, would get offended by a word that they know in their heart, like in our hearts, what our intention is, yes, how we're choosing to connect. Like that, that's why it just feels like, it's like, no, God isn't offended. You're offended because yes, you're afraid, because you don't like, because we don't let our minds go there. We don't ask those questions, or we're really just trying to stick to like, well, I'm not worthy of interpreting things for myself, because like you have to be a learned scholar. Like there's this notion of like, unless you're a learned scholar, you can't say things out loud, which I'm not here to say like I'm a historian or I know all of the stories or all of that. That's not it at all. But I don't think that you need to be a learned scholar to ask questions and to engage in conversation with God.
Yeah, I agree. And then like, this is also the same God that has the most beautiful names ascribed to them, including the most merciful and you know, the most like loving and the most kind. And like, yeah, I don't know. I think sometimes we forget those things.
Yeah. So something that I noticed that you did in the book, you talk about, you like all of the chapters are broken up by these stories of different prophets. And I was hesitant. I was like, do I want to ask this? Do I not want to? But I was thinking about it too much. So I was like, of course I'm going to ask it. And you obviously can answer it exactly how you want to. So when it comes to queerness, the story that is always referred to in like conservative Muslim communities is the story of Lut or Lot. And you specifically did not reference, you didn't reference that story in the book. You didn't even touch on like what the traditional, you weren't like in the Quran or in tradition, in the conservative form of the tradition, this is what people think. You were just like, no, this is my story. I'm talking about it through my reflections. And you engaged so deeply and so thoughtfully with the stories of so many of the other prophets and figures in the religion. So tell me about that decision, and if it was something that you thought about, and if it was, how maybe you chose to engage with that story off the page.
That is an excellent question. You really went there.
I'm like, wait, listen, I'm a Muslim woman who's interviewing you. Like, we're just going to skip through everything. Hope that everybody reads the book and gets straight to the nitty gritty.
Yeah. So what's really interesting is that I feel like I have been engaging with that story so much since I sort of like came into my queerness, that at this point it feels like it feels like I've engaged with it so much that it's almost like boring. Because there's so many different interpretations of it, including, you know, what the people of Lot were punished for, their interpretations about how it was actually rape and not sodomy, their interpretations about sort of like their highway robbery and just like all of these other terrible things that they did. And, you know, a lot of people have written extensively about the ways in which, you know, Prophet Lut, like, offers his daughters, and like, why would he do that? Like, that's like such a weird, like what are you offering them in terms of like sex or like marriage? Like, but like marriage is never mentioned anywhere. And so I don't know, there's just like, there's a lot of like, there's a lot of layers to that story that I think we don't always fully know. And there are a lot of layers that are confusing and we just don't know. And so one of the people who has written about it is Scott Kugel in his book, Homosexuality in Islam. And yeah, I don't know. I think that there are so many different interpretations of it that I don't know, other people have written about it better than I could. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. It's interesting though, because it's like, I feel like when I talk to queer Muslims, they share that sentiment of like, there's so many different interpretations. And then when you hear people in like the communities that I grew up in, which were a lot more conservative, they're like, there's no other, there's like this, almost like this, reaction of like, there are no other interpretations. Mm. And not only are there not any other interpretations, but if you bring forth any other interpretations, the first instinctual reaction is to dismiss it or discredit the person who wrote it, mm-hmm. as if they are just trying to write something to appease themselves. And it's just like, but isn't that so limiting? Like that. And sometimes I wonder if the obscurity in that story is also just a test to see if people will choose the path of like love and acceptance, or they'll choose the path of trying to control and put people down. Because I've never, for me personally, and I, all of the things I'm saying are my personal opinions, but I feel like, you know, it's one thing to be like, everybody goes through different tests in life, but I don't feel like, you know, love is something that you get tested by in that way, where it's just like, you can experience love, but you can't have it. Like that doesn't make sense, because God is love. And right. So sometimes I wonder if like the obscurity of that story and the way that people react to it is part of the test of like, are you going to think about this through the lens of like a loving God, or are you going to think about it through the lens of like wanting to control other people? And even if you don't ever get to that place, what is the obsession with trying to control other people's bodies? Like, this is like what I keep coming back to, is like, why are we so obsessed with controlling other people's bodies, whether it comes to wearing the hijab or not wearing the hijab or queerness or transness? Like why are we like not just focused on ourselves and being a good person ourselves?
Yeah. I really, really, really love that, that reframing. And I especially love the idea that, maybe the obscurity is deliberate and there's a test in there. And also, I mean, like at the end of the day, I think, you know, it's God's place to judge us. And the best that we can do is sort of try to live a life that, feels like it's worthy of this life that God has given us.
Mm, yeah. I love that. So my whole hypothesis of why you decided to not write the story, not put that in your book, is simply because you're like, yeah, I just engaged with it way too much that I found it boring to write about.
Yes.
This is why I needed to ask, because I needed to just like get out of my head and be like, it wasn't some big philosophical scheme. It was just, that wasn't meant for the book.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell me about your relationship with writing, like, and just, if you're open to like sharing a little bit more of your background, like what role did writing play in your life? And I know you never really specifically share where your family's from and stuff, but if you're open to it, I would just love to know like the traditions that you come from that led you to choosing this as your art form.
So I read a lot as a kid and then also as a young adult. So I don't know. I think of reading as sort of like pre-writing.
It is pre-writing.
It totally is.
You're a better writer the more you read.
Agreed. So I actually didn't write until pretty late in my life, in my like late 20s. So what happened was that I would tell all these stories about how, you know, like something had happened that was like really messed up, or like some form of discrimination or something. And then I would tell people these stories. And this one time my friend was like, so, you know, you feel all of this sort of like rage and anger, and it kind of dissipates when you tell the stories. It's something that I've noticed, like you should consider writing them down instead. And I was like,
so
okay.
Anger management.
Totally. 100%. And this friend is someone who I respect a lot. And I was like, okay, let me try it. And I tried it, and I found that I really, really enjoyed it. And I found that, in addition to sort of like the like anger management aspect of it, it also allowed me to ask questions. And, you know, I'd be like stuck about something in my head, and I'd be like, you know, why do I just like keep coming back to this? Like, what about it feels so tangled? And I found that when I wrote about it, it like it didn't necessarily disentangle it, but it allowed me to look at it from different aspects and like ask different questions and just really, really just like get a better picture of it. So that's how I started writing. I wrote essays at first. And then I found myself writing this essay about Hajar, which is like one of the essays that comes towards the end of the book. I found myself writing it. And then I realized that in some ways, like the essays in this book are essays that I've been sort of like, they're things that I've been thinking about my whole life. And so writing the book sort of like followed naturally from there.
How long did writing this book take you?
It took about, I'd say like maybe a year and a half. The pandemic shutdown happened when I was about maybe like a third of the way through it. And I have the kind of job where I have to be in person for it. And I couldn't work from home. And so suddenly I had all this sort of like time and space to write. So I found myself sort of like speeding through writing the rest of it pretty fast.
What did your writing days look like?
A lot of, early pandemic stuff, cooking elaborate meals, doing a lot of writing in between, and then a lot of Zoom workouts to really get those juices flowing.
Working out, good food, and
time and space.
Yeah.
I also, this thing happens to me when I'm like working on an essay where I feel sort of like consumed by it. And I find myself thinking about it a lot, in ways that feel really fun. So I'll be like taking a shower and then I'll have like all of these sort of like, ideas, or I'll be like on a walk, and I'll have these ideas. And so there's this way in which it feels like I'm not a person who is like a daily practice, who has like a daily writing practice. I wish I was like a lot more disciplined in that way. But I definitely am the kind of person where once I get my teeth into an essay, it feels like I can't let go.
Oh, amazing. Are you working on any writing now?
I am, but it's like so much in the beginning stages that it feels weird to talk about.
Okay. So like not even like a hint, not even like a, is it like memoir? Is it fiction?
No, I can give you a little bit more, since you asked so nicely. It's fiction, and the general theme is going to be about it's going to be about sort of like creative resistance in the Gulf, and the way in which people who live there are able to find ways to resist despite constraints.
Love that. I mean, yeah, you have such an interesting story of like your family being from a Southeast Asian country and then living in the Gulf and then moving to New York and like becoming this like New Yorker, this definition of what it means to be in New York. And it's, I'm so excited. That's amazing. Go for it.
Oh, I was just going to say best city in the world.
Truly. Your social media situation is Lamia is angry. Are you still angry?
Yeah, I am. And, I don't think that's a bad thing.
You sound so happy in your voice. Like, what is anger? How have you redefined anger?
That's a really good question. You know, I was always an angry kid. As I've sort of like grown up, to me, anger has actually become like a motivating force towards justice. I know that there's this way in which, you know, even like Islamically, you're taught that anger is like something that, you know, if you're standing up, you should sit down. If you're sitting down, you should lie down. It's something that you're supposed to like let dissipate. But for me, anger has actually been something that I've been able to channel into things like writing or organizing or activism. And so to me, just like, I don't know, I don't ever want to lose the ability to be angry at things, especially, especially at injustice.
Love that. I love it. Hi there. I want to share with you a good deed opportunity. At ICU Foundation, we work to alleviate local homelessness and directly serve community members in need. We do this through our community pantry, family food bags, hygiene kits, snack bags, winter care packages, and grocery gift cards. Lately, we've been seeing incredible impact by partnering with businesses and organizations to host volunteer events where their teams make and distribute the ICU care bags. ICU is our response to a community member who, when we asked what she needed most, responded with, "We just need to be seen." So, if you would like to join us in seeing and serving the community, email us at contact@isyfoundation.org. Okay, back to the show.
I also feel like I got a sense of some of your existential crises. Is that correct?
Yes, that's so correct. That's so correct, but it's a part of the journey, right? Like it's what we're on the planet to experience. That's why I welcome it. I mean, I know it's like not easy and none of it is, but I welcome it. And I have so many queer friends and I have really redefined community for myself in so many ways. And I realized that for me, community is really about collecting people who lead with love and service and curiosity and are very open and ask questions without the intention of getting an answer or imposing their beliefs onto you, but simply as like a way to witness one another. And so I tend to gravitate towards people that give me the space to just be instead of trying to like fix anything. And I feel like growing up that it was a little bit different. And I've asked questions since I was a kid, so that has never changed, but it's as I'm evolving and growing up that I'm realizing, oh, not all questions are welcome to everyone, or just questions just make people really uncomfortable. But that feels like the power of a question and why we need to be asking them, why we need to be asking them more. So I'm grateful for the questions that you've posed here and in your book and how you talk to, how you just approach things. But I keep thinking about like young queer Muslims who are really just struggling in this. And, you know, there are some tragic stories that I have happened in our spaces of, people, you know, dying by suicide, when they haven't been able to reckon their own identities, or people, you know, just, I mean, I don't have to describe them. You know these stories, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But I would love to just hear you speak to a person who is a queer person of a faith tradition that doesn't welcome queerness and is wondering if life is for them.
Wow, that is... That's a really good question, and one that is really hard to answer. What I would tell myself when I was younger is that the joys, and there will be joys, are so worth it. I know that's not a very sort of like comprehensive answer, and
Well, you also, I literally realized as I asked you that, and it is, where is it? Right in the beginning of the book, you literally write about not wanting to be alive, but it wasn't in a dramatic way. It wasn't in a like, it was just a very like clear fact. Like it was just like, this is how I felt. And yeah, this is what I'm going to do with this feeling.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely something that I remember vividly, this like idea of wanting to disappear. It wasn't even like a wanting to die. It was just like a wanting to not have been, if that makes sense. Yeah. And, you know, there are, I don't know, I think like in some ways, some of that just never goes away. But there has been so much joy in my life. And there's been so much beauty and so much love. I wish that I could go back to the younger me and, I don't know, tell that kid that those would be things that would make everything worth it.
Mm. Now I have a little bit of a more, maybe even more uncomfortable one, but I'm going to ask it. And if you say no, then that's absolutely beautiful and fine. But, you know, you're on here completely anonymously. I have no idea who you are, what your real name is. I'm assuming it's not Lemia, but I do feel like I have a sense of who you are for sure. Mm. And, but I would love to ask the person behind Lemia, if you ever did feel like you wanted to share a little bit more about who you were or who you are with your parents or sibling, what would you say to them? Like, what do you want them to know?
So I have shared with my sibling, with my brother, and he was really, really amazing and just like so lovely. But yeah, I mean, I wish my parents, I wish they knew how much love is in my life.
I can feel how grounded you are and how like clear you are and how you've really made this life your own. And it's such an honor to witness it on the page and on the pod, and just, I look forward to seeing what comes next and what other stories come out of you.
Yeah, same. I'm also excited to see, where this like giant experiment in being a person goes, which we're all doing, right? We're all engaged in this giant experiment of being a person. Yeah.
So the way we wrap these conversations is with a fill in the blank. So The prompt is, if you really knew me, you would know. You can share one, two, or three things.
Okay. This is so, in quote, cringe, but I have to say it. I love emojis. I'm so into them. I, you know, really like contain myself when I'm texting. But if I could, I would just text in emojis. I think that they offer a really fun way to open up what you're saying to interpretation.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
What's your favorite?
Oh my God. These days I'm really into the one where it's like a little melty smiley, like the smiley.
Oh my gosh. My mom sends me that one all the time.
Oh my God. Wow. Me and your mom. Yeah. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. Wow.
Any other, if you really knew me, that's a really good one.
I really want to run a marathon one day. I haven't yet, but I'm waiting for the right time. I feel like it's something that I would get really, really into. And the last thing I need right now is more things that I'm really, really into. But it's on my list. It's on my list of to-do things.
Wait, what else are you really into?
You know, like I started this whole writing thing and I thought it would just be a hobby, but like now I'm so into it and I just like can't stop doing it. I'm really into that. That's a big thing. I'm really into learning how to drive. I am off the generation that just like that grew up, where I grew up, that just like didn't learn how to drive. So I'm like really into learning how to drive right now.
Wow. I love it. Lamia, thank you so much. I'm going to do this thing that I just heard Adam Grant start doing, and I didn't realize I was going to do this until this very moment, but he's been wrapping his podcast episodes asking his guests if they have any questions for him. And since this was a two-way conversation, and you absolutely don't need to do this, but just in case, are there any questions that you may have for me in this upward spiral?
Wow. I guess, like, how is your heart feeling?
Thank you for asking. Yeah. It's like the worst question anyone can ask me. It's so funny. I always tell people I ask the question, but then I like hold my breath and I hope nobody asks me back. I don't know if that's hypocritical, but my heart today is feeling really grounded and relieved. I feel like I have, you know, I've really gone through a lot in the last couple of months, but I like say couple of months, but it's actually been a lot longer and a lot shorter and everything in between. It's just been really, really intense. And so today I feel really grounded and grateful. I was really looking forward to this conversation. And I just really wanted you to know that we are here to be of service in any way that we can, and that your work is so important. Your words and your story is so important. And it is an honor to get people riled up simply by sharing your book, because like that just tells me how much we all need it.
Mm.
That's how my heart's doing.
Such a good answer.
Thank you so much, Lamia. I'm so happy that we got to talk.
Me too.
Amazing.
Podcast Nood is an At Your Service production. Producers include myself, Adam Khafif, and Sara Issa. Editing by Nuran Morsi. The theme music is the song Thunderdome, Welcome to America by Portugal the Man. Extra gratitude and thanks to our storyteller, Lamia H. And make sure you get a copy of their memoir, Hijab Butch Blues. You can find Lamia on social media @LamiaIsAngry. As always, at your service.